So, cup of tea, check. Biscuits, check. Mike, check.
Hello.
We're all here for... Tux... No. We're all here for Linux Voice Podcast Series 2, Episode 2, live. Recorded live from Ben's house in Gloucester. Hey, Ben. Yeah,
thanks,
Hello.
Ben.
Hello.
We've got news, and we've got finds of the fortnight, and a halfway reminder, and vocalise your neurons, and maybe a challenge if we're lucky. Also, voice of the masses, which is epic. This podcast is brought to you by the people who make Linux Voice, which is a magazine about Linux and free software and all that stuff. We are frantically writing this magazine. And laying it out and doing all sorts of stuff, like talking to HMRC about tax and things like that. It's oh dear, it's I want to have a bit of a lie down.
What have we got ourselves into?
I don't know. I don't know, but we just need to think. What would Hannibal do?
What did Hannibal
from the
18? Did he really do that thing?
March the elephants over the Alps.
I was thinking of constructing the tank in the garage before driving out and defeating all the bad guys with Mr. T.
Yeah,
or eating people with a glass of Chianti.
If Hannibal from Carthage had had a tank, history would have been very different. But no, this is Linux Voice and we're podcasting. If you want to buy our magazine, which is available on paper and on neurons, and on electrons, sorry, but mainly it exists in our neurons at this stage. You can do so at shop.linuxvoice.com. And there are a variety of attractive payment options there. And the magazine is going to be great. So let's start podcasting, shall we?
Yeah. Should we say who we are?
Oh, I forgot that. I've just subsumed myself into the collective now. There is no Andrew Gregory anymore. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
Okay, the news. The first item up this fortnight. Ubuntu is officially the most secure operating system in Britain, according to the Communication Electronic Security Group. They sound fancy.
Aren't they almost your neighbours?
They are, actually. They're in GCHQ, which is just over yonder.
Very, just down this tunnel.
Yeah, very deep in the limestone. They looked at all the sort of main operating systems, although Ubuntu was the only Linux, and it was Ubuntu 12.04 they looked at. And, I don't know, some people are making a lot of this. In truth, it came up almost identical to Windows No XX, except for the update policy. They didn't count the VPN or full disk encryption because it hasn't been independently vetted. But other than that, they looked at it and went, yeah, it looks good. I mean, obviously, it's no surprise to anyone that Linux is a secure OS.
But it would have been nice if they'd, you know, included some others in there as well, like OpenBSD or OpenVMS, just for the lulz, you know, because those operating systems can take a bit of a beating.
I don't know if the Communication Electronic Security Group do many things for the lulz.
But why did they do this? I mean, can we consider them impartial? Did somebody pay them to look into it?
No, it's a sort of standard review they did go through. They're responsible for basically providing guidance to all government departments on what stuff is classified for what level of security. This is all to do what they call the official level, so it still doesn't count to secret and top secret classifications. And it is, I mean, they've been very thorough. They've gone through pretty much every part of it. And it's certainly a big sort of pat on the back saying this is independently verified to say it's better than the rest, even if it is only very slightly better.
Yeah, but I mean, in comparison, well, there's so many other advantages to choosing, even if it's Ubuntu 12.04, you know, to Microsoft something or other, you know, and it's a great endorsement.
Yeah, and also a couple of down points, the stuff that hadn't been certified. I think Canonical are working on certification for 12.04, so it could be even better in the next place.
For 13.04.
It was 14. I've got my years all confused.
Oh, Mike wants to say something.
But doesn't this sort of defy the point? If the Communications Electronic Security Group is part of GHCQ, then GHCQ wants us all using unsecure software so they can load it with backdoors and tap all our data. Why are they telling us to use secure operating systems?
They want us to think that the operating systems are secure so that we have lots of secret conversations about things.
I think actually GCHQ are acting in our best interest.
You've got nothing to
hide.
Why
are you laughing?
Sorry.
To be fair, this guidance isn't for general consumers. This is provided for the government
agents.
And for, yeah.
This is sweet.
This is for the James Bonds of the world.
James Bond would clearly use MicOS.
Whilst drinking a... some sort of drink.
I don't think James Bond uses an OS. He just flicks a button on and off really fast.
The thing that caught my eye about this story was that, exactly as you said, this has been spun as Ubuntu is Tebestors, whereas actually it could just as easily be Debian or Mint or something. You know, Ubuntu has taken on a range. We joked that a few years ago that Ubuntu was becoming synonymous with desktop Linux, and it seems now this is evidence that is happening at the high echelons of covert espionage, which is nice. You know, good for them. Really great work from their marketing people. Because if Ubuntu wins, then everybody wins.
And if it takes somebody like... If Canonical has now got to go off and get those other bits ratified or whatever they needed to do, what does that mean for other distributions? Distribution like Debian, for example, that probably hasn't got the resources or the motivation, perhaps, to do the same kind of things.
It's hard to say. I suspect they'd have to do it against a specific version, possibly even a specific binary package to verify that that's exactly what it was. So for something like Debian, you probably could just take an Ubuntu one and put it straight on there. For something like Fedora, you probably couldn't. Because of the different packaging systems and everything. So certainly, as you say, any Mint or Debian or anything, obviously it all extends to it. Perhaps the only specific Ubuntu thing in here was the long-term release support, which was important as well.
Maybe the provision of paid-for support as well. Must have been part of it. Which also limits the range.
But overall, I think it's a great win for Ubuntu, and it's just another thing just to say, yes, Linux is ready.
Yeah, to get any official in the UK paid for by the the public purse recognising that there is something called Linux, even if it's called Ubuntu, is a very good thing.
Second up on the news, the first Firefox tablet specs have been revealed. It's sort of a 10-inch tablet, quad-core, 16-gig internal memory, fairly low-end device.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, 1 gigahertz, sort of 2 gigs of RAM. But apparently this exists at the moment, sold under a different brand with Android for $150. And the reviews that I've seen generally complain about the performance, but that is performance under Android. So maybe under Firefox OS it would be better, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen, really. It's hard to know from the specs, but it looks reasonable. I mean, it's clearly an entry-level device. It's never going to be anything else. As you say, they're sort of talking about £100 price range. So,
do you know where it's going to be on sale?
No.
In which territories?
I don't think they've said which territories, although they've hinted that it's going to be emerging markets.
eBay, then.
Yeah. As you say, it's one that's being made already, so I'd imagine it'd be relatively straightforward just to ramp up manufacture if there was interest in other areas.
Well, I think it's good just to have more choice in the mobile operating system market anyway. Things seem to be getting a bit stagnant with just Android versus iOS and back and forth. You know, we need more choices.
And I must admit, I must have just skimmed it through my Twitter feed, but did I see that there weren't going to be any Ubuntu phones this year? They were going to be pushed back to 2015.
Yeah, Jono said that.
Which is disappointing. because I'm sure they said that, you know, they'll be manufacturing them just right about now.
Yeah, it's a big loss if they can't get them out this year.
Yeah.
I mean, we're getting obviously Firefang out now, and Sailfish ones are out. They're out now as well, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So by the time Ubuntu phone comes out, if one of those has managed to make itself the third player in the market, it'll be incredibly hard for Ubuntu phone to crack in there.
Did Jono say why? Is this there's something to do with the logistics of dealing with their secret partner, who maybe they want to spend a year, you know, Nokia wants to spend a year working with Canonical?
That was the implication I got, but I don't think I actually saw it stated anywhere. But yeah, going back to what you said there, Mike, about it always being good to have a more competition in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese government has entered the marketplace as well. They've created COS, the China Operating System.
Awesome.
Which, to be honest, it looked like Android to me, but with Chinese characters on it instead. Without having gone through it fully, I can't say exactly.
Did anybody see the promotional video for it?
I didn't know.
No? Oh, it's brilliant. You've got to see it. It's about 2.5 minutes long, but it's like an epic film trailer. It opens with this huge orchestral score, and it goes back 5,000 years of history, showing all these Chinese inventions, eventually leading to COS.
Are you sure that's just not a Reddit video?
No, it's on their actual page. The funny part is that eventually it shows some guy using COS to play a game, and a message pops up on the screen. And when the message pops up, it plays the exact same new message tone from iOS. So they're not doing themselves any favours, given that, you know, Chinese tech has a reputation for ripping off Western tech.
Do you reckon Apple will try and take the Chinese government to court?
That would be something.
Some of you may remember that this isn't the Chinese government's first attempt at a phone operating system. There was the O-Phone in 2009, discontinued in 2010.
No, I don't remember that.
No.
I remember Turbo Linux, that well-known Chinese operating system.
That was Japanese.
Well, yeah, the version I reviewed was Turbo Linux Fuji, which was a bit of a clue. Somehow I managed to get China and Japan mixed up.
So are they making all their changes, their source code changes, available for people to download?
I haven't seen it anywhere, but...
Who's going to ask them politely to do so?
Look, Linus Torvalds.
Richard Stallman.
Okay, moving on. Our next item of news. Net neutrality has been struck down in the US. This is the news. They've always been said that cable operators, companies that provide broadband, have to provide it without preference to particular types of internet activity. They couldn't, for example, give YouTube better access than... I don't know, Reddit or anything like that. It always has to be equal. A packet is a packet. And the courts have said no. They can do whatever they like. They can let companies pay for faster access. Graham, you're shaking your head there.
Well, I haven't had the time to look into this, but I know that the legislation, a bit like, has been fought time and time again, you know, for several years, and I thought that the battle had been won sometime last year, and it's just totally depressing that it isn't the case, that net neutrality is going to become something we'll talk fondly to our grandchildren, and they won't believe us when they're watching a million adverts when they're just trying to read the BBC.
I mean, there's different ways to look at it, because, I mean, yeah, they previously had this thing at the point, the last level from your ISP to your home, but above that, it's not neutral. You know, YouTube can get an extra line into your ISP and bypass the main, and they can provide, you know, there's plenty of ways for a large company to spend money to get internet faster to you. So, and this, does this change that? I mean, or did it?
Well, just thinking off the top of my head, I imagine what it will mean is like Machiavellian partnerships between broadband providers and content providers.
Those already exist, though.
But with the net with the legislation that everybody was trying to get recognised, they still had to provide their competitors with the same level of access.
They didn't, actually. They just couldn't. I believe they didn't. They just didn't have.
They didn't have to use their pipes, obviously, but they couldn't. When it came to somebody's a router at home, you couldn't say,
"Yeah,
you need to give preference to Netflix or not Netflix or whatever it happened to be."
That's true, but they could give a fast pipe from Google's YouTube server straight into their main access point. I mean, it seems like a bigger thing to me for things like where the content providers are, the broadband providers. I'm thinking Google, obviously, in America. And I know this doesn't apply to the UK, but there's a lot of cases in the UK now. In fact, every major ISP is also a content provider. Sky, BT, and Virgin.
Yeah, yeah.
Etc. So, yeah, I think, I don't know.
Doesn't it give them kind of carte blanche to make their competitors' packets mysteriously disappear?
I don't think they can make them disappear. I don't think
reboot them. I guess, I mean, it's a long slippery slide that started. I mean, in the UK, it's a bit of a joke to talk about net neutrality when you legitimate. I mean, just yesterday I was trying to download a torrent of a dual layer Linux distribution, unfortunately hosted on places like Pirate Bay, which I could not access. And, you know, it's a bit stupid when you can't actually access some sites anyway.
Why were you trying to download a dual layer Linux distribution?
Just for my own amusement.
Yeah, as soon as I try and torrent anything, my internet cuts off.
Does it?
Yeah, you stop the torrent, wait 10 minutes and it comes back up.
Weird.
Mm. To be honest, it does so with some big uploads as well. But yeah, it was a few months ago, not long after I moved in, my place of work's at the front of the house, and a police van turned up, the telephone, I don't know what they call them, exchange, the little box as well, the telephone wires go. Police van pulled up, someone got out, and yeah, started work on the telephone box. And apparently it happened a few weeks later as well. My girlfriend saw it happening. The police are doing something to the telephone exchange here.
Uh-oh.
Be this the house of beat the CIA Ben ever heard.
Never heard of him. moving on. The final item of news this fortnight. Fedora 21 is going to have no name.
Mm. Is that like Clint Eastwood's character in all the spaghetti westerns he did? He didn't have a name.
Does this fit with their cryptic naming policy that I just don't understand?
It could be. It'd be like the distro formerly known as Schrodinger's Cat, or whatever it was.
Heisenbug or Beefy Miracle. I don't get it.
Yeah. Now, apparently they decided the name thing was getting a bit ridiculous.
That's why it was good.
And it's also going to be a lot later than expected. Typically they've done 6-month-ish releases, so they've been late for most of them, but 6-month-ish. This one is pushed back to at least August. I don't know. To me, it makes a certain amount of sense, because short releases are really good when you're changing little things. You put out some changes, you get user feedback, and you can iterate really quickly. But at the moment, there seem to be some quite big changes going on in distros, Wayland obviously being the big one. Mm. And if you're trying to fit something like Wayland into a 6-month release, do you really have time to test it and do everything properly? Or are you better off just taking a little extra time and doing it right?
No, I think you're right. And also there's a lot of promises are being made at the moment about Wayland, for example, or what may make it into the next distribution, and it doesn't seem to happen. For the last couple of years, things are changing so much, like with the GNOME desktop.
Yeah.
And distributions haven't been able to deliver the same quality that we had.
Yeah, there's been this
2 years ago.
Yeah, there's been this sort of rush to get the very latest bit of software in the release, but at the expense of getting the big changes done right.
I like the name thing. I think 21 just sounds clean, and it's time for a change.
Yeah, it's a decade old now. They've got to grow up, be mature and sensible. Can't give themselves 21, silly.
21, coming
name.
Of age.
Yeah, they get the key to the house. And that's the news.
Excellent news. Thanks, Ben. So it's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. I don't know if we've mentioned it, but we are all insanely busy. I don't know, we say that every episode, but I've spent quite a bit of time using Linux, but I haven't discovered very much. I have got something to talk about, but how about you guys? Have you had much time to play with Linux?
I've been discovering stuff in the course of making the magazine and doing stuff. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Ditto, yeah.
Like multitasking or something.
What is this?
What, in the operating system or in your head?
It's both. I've got a printout of the scheduler and I just follow it through. I set a nice value for every task I've got to do. Yeah. So yeah, I'll jump in first if that's right.
That's awesome, Ben.
The first thing is, I've always said I don't like PHP. I always find it, whenever I try and program it, I end up with a complete mess of spaghetti code and HTML and PHP and all jumbled in. I can never work out what's going on. This week I've been using PHP in WordPress, and there's a huge amount of functions and everything all built in, ready to use, blah, blah, blah. And I can finally see how PHP should be done. And it's not as bad as I thought it was. So I guess my discovery, or my find, is that PHP isn't as rubbish as I thought it is, but it's very easy to make it rubbish if you're not careful with doing stuff properly in the first place.
So what is it good for?
It's good for, I don't know, dynamic web pages, really. If you want to chuck data and stuff that you have stored elsewhere in the middle of HTML, then it works fairly well. I won't go as far to say it works really well, but it works fairly well.
That's a good discovery.
You've been working on linuxvoice.com, haven't you?
I have.
You've been making it awesome, haven't you?
I've been attempting to.
It looks fantastic what you've been able to do. So I should have a look and have a look and see how you've done it.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, if anyone out there is looking into getting started in PHP development, then get started with WordPress, because it will show you how to do it right, and then move on to other stuff.
Right, that's really good.
My second discovery, I've got three in total. It's OwnCloud 6 documents. We've talked about them before. You can open your ODT documents in OwnCloud. And I hadn't used it before. And we've got it up and running for our team site at the moment. And it's really useful. Just, you know, you've uploaded stuff, you send it to someone else. Oh, just need to check something. One little change. Whip in, make the edit. I'm not sure I'd yet trust it to use as a full word processor. It seemed a little bit iffy at times.
Yeah.
But for little, I mean, it's the first release of it, first version. I wouldn't expect it to be perfect. And for little changes and checking stuff out, it works really well.
Excellent. I haven't tried it. I tried it when I installed the beta, but I haven't gone back to it and tried it. I really need a word count. But for changes like that, I can see how it really works. I do use Google Docs quite a bit, even though I'm trying to move away from it. But also, I quite like Google Docs has got a great definition feature, which is something like Control, Alt, Shift, and Y. And it brings up a definition of a word, which is handy because I never know what I'm writing.
I find what am I talking about? The spell checker in Google Docs scares me a little bit. It's too good. It's stuff like, I was doing a piece for another magazine last year on Everest, and I was talking about a climber who did something. And I misspelled his name, but I misspelled it so it was still a valid name. But it highlighted it. It recognised that the article is about Everest.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure I want Google to be able to tell that.
It's got pretty similar kind of grammar checking as well, which I find really good in it being unobtrusive. You know, unlike Microsoft Word, if you've ever tried that one. Yeah,
fragment.
Well, I don't ever use a grammar checker, but the Google makes some very common sense suggestions when it's recognised you've done something wrong. Or two ands, or something like that.
Yeah. And my final discovery this fortnight is, again, with the servers, I was putting a backup system in place, and I was like, well, obviously I don't want to just keep copying the whole lot and do some form of incremental backup. And I discovered there's just the listed incremental flag in TAR, where you can keep essentially a log file, and that keeps a log of everything you've already backed up. And if you use this option when you create a new archive, it just creates copies in the new files. So,
I didn't get it. I'm just reading really slow today. Sorry.
So you've got, say, a data directory that you want to back up full of files.
Yeah.
You make a TAR archive of it.
Yeah.
Great. A day later, you want, you know, want to keep a backup, but you don't want to back up everything because you've got most of it.
Yeah.
You just need the new files. The listed incremental option will create a second TAR file with just the new files in it.
Oh, okay, okay. So what about changes to the old files?
I hope it copies them in as well.
To the new arc, does it do delta changes? I mean, I was thinking like rsync just seems perfect for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, rsync's good. But if you've got like a live copy between two, this is sort of an archive copy.
Right, right.
So you're just sort of taking out and you're just taking the extra day's changes each time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually got both rsync and TAR with incremental backups running on our sites.
That's brilliant.
Keeping everything good and safe.
I have noticed that the IT support is much better than our old place. thanks, Ben. Shall I go next? I mean, for the first issue, I'm writing a tutorial on. I've mentioned it before, but the Brew Pie. The Brew Pie is a fantastic project, which is basically a shield for an Arduino, you know, a little microcontroller board that then connects to a Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi doesn't really do much other than shuttles the data off the Arduino and makes it available through a web front end. The Arduino itself is running an algorithm that is, when it's attached to a couple of sensors that you put inside a fridge or a freezer, regulates the temperature inside the fridge or the freezer by either turning on the freezing function or turning on a heating function. The idea being that you put a probe inside a bin of fermenting beer and you can get it to stay, well, within a tenth of a degree of the temperature that you want to set at. It's a good tutorial because unless you know a lot about brewing beer and quite a lot about putting soldering components onto Arduino shields, there isn't really that much documentation out there. So I've had to discover a lot in the process of doing this. But what my discovery is that it really works. When I got it working on Saturday and put it all together, so I put it into a freezer that someone very generously gave me. I bought a little greenhouse heater, which is £15 on eBay, that I've screwed into the bottom of the freezer. And I haven't gone into, lots of people go into a lot of detail about reverse engineering the circuits inside the fridge. And all I did was I used the solid state relays that came with the BrewPi kit to just turn on the fridge or turn on the heater. I didn't do anything clever, but it works perfectly. And to test it, I put in the fermenting bin with a load of water at 50 degrees inside the freezer and watched how the algorithm running on the BrewPi regulated the temperature and brought it down to 18 degrees. And it's so clever. You can see it pulsing the fridge in decreasing quantities until it realizes where it's going to, where if you can imagine the temperature on a graph kind of freewheeling after the freezing function has stopped, it knows exactly when the peak of the curve is going to be so that it just hits 18 degrees. And another nice thing about it is that you can tell it what temperature to do over time. So with the brew that I put in on the Saturday evening, I started off at like 20 degrees and brought it down to 18 degrees over the next 48 hours and just keep it going like that for the whole week. And not only is it, you know, brewing awesome beer, you can really get geekily fascinated by all of the numbers and you keep refreshing the web page to see how it's doing. And it's a really great project.
When are we going to be able to test the first batch of Brew Graham?
Another 10 days, I think, yeah. It's going to be fermenting for a week and then, yeah, maybe another week or two to stick it in some bottles.
What is it?
It's ale, really. I used a kit. Yeah. I just used a kit that I had for 2 years in the garage, so I didn't know even whether the yeast would work. But I can't even remember what it is.
It's Woodford's Wherry.
Oh, Woodford's Wherry. Thanks. Thanks, Andrew.
From the beautiful east coast of England.
Isn't a wherry a kind of a boat or a yacht or something?
It is, yeah.
It's an old sailing barge, isn't it?
Yeah. Is it from that part of the world, from the fens?
Taking stuff in and out of the tidal creeks round the coast to London.
Yeah, so maybe for the next podcast, and I think we'll have Mike with us as well, actually physically with us, so next podcast, great beer, hopefully. That's really my discovery. I spent a lot of time doing that, so I haven't had much time to do anything else.
I've got a couple of discoveries. First discovery is that I'm still allergic to cats. Good work, Ben's cat.
Can we have a picture of Ben's cat to go along with the podcast?
Yeah, we can. He was supposed to be in surgery today. He got in a fight a couple of weeks ago, which is why we're recording here. But we took him in, and the vet had a look at him, and he got scratched in his eye, and he had an ulcer or something on there. And he took it in today, and he said, actually, it's healing on its own.
So that's good.
So I guess I've got another discovery, is my cat's harder than I thought he was.
What's your cat's name?
Zapper.
Curse you, Zapper. So, my other discovery is comes from our political class, or from Ireland's political class. They're still the same class of people, whatever country they're in. They do the same sort of things. This is Patrick O'Donovan, who is the Fine Gael MP for Limerick. He says, an online black market is operating, which protects the user's anonymity and operates across borders through the use of open source internet browsers and payment systems which allow users to remain anonymous. This effectively operates as an online supermarket for illegal goods such as drugs, weapons and pornography.
Is pornography illegal?
Blah, blah, blah. I hope not. We need a national and international response to clamp down on this illicit trade. The illicit trade in open source internet browsers. So par for the course, really. Internet politician said something ill-informed. So what? That's not news. That's not a discovery, I hear you say. That's just normality. Well, the thing that makes that rather more concerning is that he's a member of the Irish Parliament's Transport and Communications Committee. Oh. So this should be his area of expertise.
Can we get him for an interview, do you
think? That would be great. And prior to being an MP, he worked as an industrial chemist. So he should know, like, maths and things. Like, have
proprietary maths.
So he's saying that there are now these systems that you can use to buy things anonymously, like cash. Does he want to ban cash as well? It's pretty anonymous, as far as I know.
You can use cash to buy drugs.
Ban this.
Ergo, down with this sort of thing. So this is predictably, you know, Twitter and the internet were very quick to point out his idiocy. To which his response was, my concern relates to the use of anonymous networks for illicit online trade. The substance of my concern stands. Need to brush up on my tech speak.
What? Tech speak?
He's so leet.
You can buy things anonymously, therefore it's dangerous and we have to ban it. The individual has the freedom to not be continuously monitored by the state, therefore...
Ooh, scary pedos! Somebody's told him Tor is open source.
Yeah.
And that's all that he's like.
That's it, that's all that's going on.
He doesn't know what those words mean. Somebody has just said Tor is open source.
You know, all the high-end decision-making that goes hand-in-hand with being an MP for Limerick. he's somehow become confused.
And it didn't rhyme.
Those are my discoveries.
That leaves you, Mike.
Hooray! I do. I've actually made loads of Linux-related discoveries, but I've put them into the magazine. because I'm writing
Hang on,
cover
you
feature.
Want people to pay for your discoveries? Proprietary evil discoveries.
I might read out like the first three words of each discovery, and then, yeah, people can buy the magazine.
Or wait 9 months.
Yeah, I'll wait 9 months till it's CC by A. No, but I did find out two other things. One was about end-user license agreements. Now, we all know that they're far too long, and nobody likes reading them, and they're just full of legalese. Well, I found out, this goes back a bit, but in 2005, a company that makes PC tune-up software called PC Pitstop put something in its end user license agreement. It asked users to email a certain address, and the first person to do so would get a check for $1,000. Now, it took 4 months and 3,000 downloads before anybody actually emailed them. And they did get the $1,000. And this company, this PC Pitstop company, talked about this as an example of saying, look, end user license agreements are ridiculous. Are they even enforceable because nobody reads them because they're deliberately made so ridiculously long?
That's a good story.
So, yeah, but even though it was a while back, I'd never heard of it. And the second discovery I've made is that currently I live really close to the North Korean embassy in Vienna.
is that for any specific reason?
There is a Linux.
You need to make a quick getaway.
Just a red dot just appeared on your head, Mike. That duck.
Hang on a minute. I was walking past and I saw the plaque. And I took a photo and some guy came out and just looked at me. And it was the first time I've ever actually been nervous in this city. And it was because of North Korea. But being a proper Linux journalist and everything, I emailed them the next day. And I asked them if they could put me in touch with anybody who works on Red Star OS. That's the North Korean version of Linux. And I said, look, I'm not going to get into politics and all this business, but can you put me in touch
with someone? Not the GNOME or KDE. Is best.
But I haven't heard back from them yet. I'd like to think that Kim Jong-un is reading my email somewhere, drinking his cognac, listening to Elvis, but I don't think we'll hear anything back from them. But if we do, then yeah, there will be an interview with a North Korean in Linux.
Your last interview.
Isn't it Theresa May at GCHQ? Drinking cognac, reading your emails and listening to Elvis.
Probably, actually, yeah. There we go.
Those discoveries bring us to our halfway reminder, which, as is traditional with the Linux Boys podcast, is about two-thirds to three-quarters of the way through the podcast.
Still to come, we have Vocalize Your Neurons, the results of our challenge, which we will skip over daintily like Nureyev, and Voice of the Masses.
So, Vocalize Your Neurons.
Yes, we do have some neurons here, sent in from Ofikal Ravatko FX. I presume he meant his name's supposed to be official, but he writes it as Ofikal, so who am I to change it? Okay, listen to this, because it's quite a mixture of neurons. I am an audiophile, and I have been looking high and far for a decent Linux music player with an album art browser, SoundCloud player, Crossfader, and that's stable. The closest I have found is Clementine, yet it does not have an album art browser. In other news, I found that the sun will get ever so slightly larger and brighter, that in 1 billion years the Earth's biosphere will collapse, and all plant life except evergreen conifers will survive. And then, by around 1.2 billion years from now, most of the oceans would have evaporated, thus halting most plate tectonics. Finally, does anyone know a good way to back up 100 gigabytes of movies and music? So, thanks, Ofikal Rabbit Co FX. There's a few things to deal with. You know. Graham, as our resident audio correspondent, can you recommend an audio player that will suit him?
No.
Okay.
I must admit, I use Spotify. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's, I've just become a Spotify addict, despite having many hundreds of CDs and a big music collection of my own. I just, you know, it's just so convenient.
So you don't really play locally stored music that much now?
No, I have some that isn't available on Spotify. But I find, and the Linux client on Spotify's Linux client is right up to parity with all the others as well. And you know, there's a company, and it's quite expensive, but it's great if you love music. The quality is very, very good.
Okay.
There's one. I mean, if he or she has been using Clementine, that's the KDE 3 fork of Amarok, is it not?
Or
is it Rhythmbox with the KDE front end? I'm not sure. But there's also Exale, EXAILE, which is worth a look. Or for a bigger client, then there's Banshee. I'm not sure. Not Banshee, sorry. Banshee.
Try it, yeah.
That does.
Try Banshee.
That has some album artwork that you can look flip through, but I'm not sure about crossfading.
I'd have to have a look, yeah. I used to use a player called Tomahawk, which is pretty good. And XMMS, I still think, is hard to beat.
I like XMMS. I think, the Beep music player forked from it ages ago, going back many years now. But, hopefully there's some suggestions to try there. His thing about the evergreen conifers and plate tectonics, maybe we shouldn't dwell on.
I try not to think about it.
Yeah. And how to back up 100 gigabytes of movies and music. Well, rsync, we mentioned before, is the best way to deal with these things, isn't it?
Depends what you're backing them up to, really, yeah. Rsync, I don't know if you want to burn them onto DVDs, depends how you're going to store them.
External hard drives are pretty cheap. I mean, that sounds like the perfect, they're quick as well, which is, that could be a long job in rsync.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if he's talking about backing up online, then of course, give OwnCloud a try. So thanks for that interesting mishmash of neurons there. Then if anybody else wants to have their neurons vocalized in future podcasts, email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
That brings us to our challenge report. And that brings us to Voice of the Masses.
Hooray!
So then, convergence, device convergence. Not so long ago, people used to have a phone for talking to people, and then an Amstrad emailer for emailing people, and a computer at home for computing on. But now all these devices do the same thing. They all do all things. They're becoming converged. Should the same be happening with interfaces? I mean, it is happening anyway. It seems to be happening anyway, what with the likes of Ubuntu's Unity and Windows 8's Metro interface, and the way that Apple has made the latest version of OS X look a wee bit more kiddie to make it look more like iOS. But, should it be happening? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What do you think? What does everybody think? That's what we asked. And, as usual, we got lots of well-informed answers. The first one going to be that comes from George Fabregas, who quotes Graham Morrison. He says, "No, I don't think convergence does make sense. Graham Morrison couldn't have said it better in the editorial for Linux Format 166. Do you remember what you said, Graham?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
You said, I accept that tablets and smartphones are being used more for serious work, but the desktop is an interface, and until the interfaces that connect the user to the computer are the same, I think it makes little sense to make the user interface similar.
Sounds sensible.
That sounds sensible.
that's Graham of 6 months ago or 9 months ago.
Glenn Holmer says the same thing, but I think in better words than Graham.
It probably wasn't 10 minutes after deadline.
He says, convergence is a lie. The right tool for the right job. That's it. Do you still think that, Graham?
Yeah, I do. I still think it's incredible that that's not the right word, but that Unity and GNOME 3 seem to have banked everything on touch interfaces when I don't know anybody who uses a touch screen on the GNOME desktop or Unity.
See, I'm still not convinced that GNOME 3 or GNOME Shell is designed as a touch interface. It's designed, so yeah, you could use it as touch. But I still think it's designed for a mouse, primarily. I mean, yeah, it's bigger and blockier, and it uses the whole screen. But that doesn't necessarily make it a touch interface. I mean, how would you swipe into the top left corner? And things like that. Those are all mouse gestures. I still don't particularly like using it myself. But I'm not convinced it's designed as, as a purely touch interface.
No, that's a good point.
A few more convergence naysayers here. Nicholas says, the notion of convergence has been bugging me for a long time now. I've never met anyone who wants it. It's a bit like 3D movies. Why can't I just watch the movie in 2D? I'm perfectly okay with my alarm clock being just an alarm clock and not being able to read my email on the inside of my refrigerator door. Yes.
I thought the same about 3D movies until I saw Gravity.
Yeah, me too. Gravity's really good.
That's it.
Yeah. U-O-O-U, whose real name is Drew.
Correct.
Says, it makes about as much sense as insisting that aeroplanes, cars, boats and bikes all have the same control mechanism. While some overlap, some standardisation of semiotics and widgets and so on is a good thing, making it easier for people who have used one interface to infer the use of another is a good thing.
Yeah.
Thinking that these vastly different devices, which importantly are put to vastly different uses, should all share a common interface is sheerest design idiocy.
I think, yeah, I mean, I like to use a touchpad even on my desktop machine. And I like it if if for example, the gesture controls for zooming into an image or double tapping on a web page for it to zoom into a single column of text. In fact, this is something that OS X gets quite right. I like the convergence of those gestures working across the board. I think that's a good thing. I mean, the biggest problem for me with Linux and the desktop is the fact that there doesn't seem to be any provision for high DPI displays. I mean, that should be a high priority. You just can't do it at the moment. There isn't a good way of. It's the same with Windows as well. And OS X kind of gets it all right, but forget about convergence. Deal with the hardware revolution happening with screens. And Android does it. Android does quite well.
I think it's time to balance this one-sided debate by introducing some pro-conversion thoughts. Tony says, yes, convergence is good, but only if it's VI. Slacker says, for me, multiple devices with multiple interfaces works just fine. I, along with a multitude of techies, am very flexible, and the GUI does not really matter. My wife would love to have the same interface everywhere. She does not like change and is not a big fan of learning a new GUI on different devices, nor am I. So a convergence will probably work well when dealing with the majority of the population. Learn it once and you are done. It is the same on all of your devices. And Les W says, my gut feeling is that the idea doesn't make sense. But when I think about the controls for my central heating system, yes, I hear you, I have to reconsider programming that appliance. It's cumbersome, to say the least. It might be easier with a touchscreen. Now, if it had one of those, the idea of an easy-to-use standard interface would be appealing. So maybe the idea has some merits after all, and not just in the realm of phone, TV, PC devices.
Hmm.
That does make sense. So if you have a standard interface for your phone and for your desktop PC, and then you get in your car and that has the in-car sat-nav thing, and that's the same sort of interface or similar interface.
It is.
Printer. Imagine if the printer made as much sense as your desktop.
Yeah.
Printer interfaces are all terrible.
Mm.
Or if, as you say, once you've used Android and you use Android on a smartphone or you use it on a tablet, you know how to use it.
Yes.
And if it was Android on your printer, you'd know how to get to the settings dialog, That is, if Canon hasn't totally destroyed the Android interface and replaced it with something hideous. It hasn't. I'm making all this up.
Now it's time for a word from our sponsors. Praise for Ubuntu. Nebuchadnezzar says, I don't think it's a smart idea to create a combined UI like Microsoft is doing with Metro. It just takes too many compromises. Something like Unity makes more sense. Switching to the matching UI depending on the way the device is currently being used. For example, when you connect an HDMI cable and a keyboard, it switches into a desktop.
Mm.
And without it, it switches back to the mobile interface. And Sultan of Swing says, yes, convergence makes sense. And I want an Ubuntu phone. I too want an Ubuntu phone. Jonathan Whitaker says that a single UI on devices with hugely different screen sizes is a terrible idea. This is where convergence a la Metro has never appealed to me. However, Canonical's approach looks really promising.
I was actually thinking this as you're reading them out. I mean, there's different ways to sort of look at convergence. And one of the things that sort of, as you mentioned, OS X and Windows, what they've done is almost take stuff out so you could simplify a desktop so you can still use it on the phone. Whereas what Canonical have done is they've still got the same interface on the desktop, and then they just, when you put it onto a smaller screen, the sort of bits drop out of it, if you were, and you sort of use it in a slightly different way. But it still has the same look and feel. If you know how to use Unity, you'll probably work out how to use the phone pretty quickly. Still not sure about it 100%, but I think it's, if you're going to do convergence, it seems a better way of doing it to me.
I guess there's an analogy might be web design. You know, back buttons, forward buttons, minimize. You take the same semiotics, but then you just resize it to fit a different shaped screen. So things still work the way that you think they'll work. Things are just given a slightly different hierarchy.
Different CSS for a different screen.
Yeah, exactly. I think Canonical's got that absolutely right with Unity. I prefer the look of the phone Unity to the desktop Unity, but if I had an Ubuntu phone, I would probably change the desktop of my laptop, which is running Mate at the moment.
I'm excited by the new look icons when they get around to doing them in Unity, because I don't really like the old ones.
For some even more balance, we have a section which I've titled, I Hate Ubuntu. No, I forgot to write down who this is from.
It's because it's you.
Unlike anyone at Canonical or Microsnot, I have actually done actual usability testing. It is blatantly obvious that an interface designed for one screen size or type will not work well on any other size or type. Convergence is a non-starter. And only people who have not actually ever done any usability testing could possibly believe that it might work. If you use actually three times in a paragraph, that means that your words are three times as valid. there's a comment from Burgess Meredith, which I'm going to leave till the end. Here we go. John C.R. says, and I like this thought, convergence makes sense for vendors, especially unprofitable vendors with resource concerns. Consumers don't care and won't. It's worth noting that Apple, for all the hype and fretting in some circles, has taken a relatively conservative stance and does not seem poised to jump feet first into a single OS for its platforms. Now, it makes sense for vendors. Does that make sense to you, Mike? The idea that it's more of the vendor that's driving this rather than consumer demand?
Well, yeah, but I was also thinking then what we were saying about websites as well, and expecting everything to be in exactly the same place across multiple interfaces. If you go to a website, most websites have a different position for, say, their login boxes or for a shopping cart and stuff like that. You sort of roughly know where to expect them, but we don't demand that all websites look and work in exactly the same way. So we are, in that sense, we are all used to things diverging. So for me, having an interface that where every single item is in exactly the same place across multiple devices isn't particularly important. I think it's the accessibility. If a setting is under a certain menu on the desktop, it should be available in the same way on a handheld device. But I don't particularly care about them looking pixel for pixel identical.
One kind of convergence that we've not talked about, which I do find beneficial, is configuration convergence, which I don't know of a solution in open source. So, for example, you set up your email accounts on Kmail on your KDE desktop. that those account settings are then synchronized with your Okanadi phone or smartphone or Android tablet and all the millions of other settings. So you can install separate tools. Firefox has got a great plugin for syncing your bookmarks with OwnCloud if you want to. You don't even have to use Mozilla's servers. You know, it'd be nice if there was an open, if OwnCloud, for example, had an API for syncing settings, and so your desktop settings were then your phone settings, were then everything else, you know, even if that includes contacts as well, because otherwise you just rely on Google or Apple or Microsoft. I like that kind of convergence a lot.
I think that's a good point. It's something we've seen ourselves recently, you know, setting up our own email. It takes one set of instructions for Android, another set of instructions for Thunderbird, yeah. And really, it's all the same stuff in the end. Yeah. The location of the mail server, the port, but everything's slightly different, different layout, different buttons, and that could be simplified so much, couldn't it?
Yes. Yeah, if you enter the details in one place, why should you have to enter them to another?
Yeah.
I tantalised you earlier with the mention of Burgess Meredith's comment.
Yes.
I think the time is now ripe to unleash that upon Burgess Meredith says, obviously the consensus is no. The idea of multiple UEs on one operating system does not make perfect sense. When I discovered desktop Linux, I tried every desktop environment available and found that I loved KDE. Years later, when I showed up late to the netbook party, I tried them all over again to find one that fit best in that format, including all the netbook-specific distros, only to find that the best, for me, was the KDE Plasma netbook workspace that was hiding in KDE all along. I loved it. I enabled it on a desktop just to try it in a larger format and hated it. So, regular KDE Plasma on the big screen, Plasma netbook on the small, and all the same KDE goodness underneath. I don't see why more operating systems don't take this approach.
Yeah.
It subverted the question.
Yeah.
And shed light.
But it's a really good point. I like the idea of it all being KDE. So KDE on a television is this big mile wide interface, you know.
You just like more KDE, don't you?
Yeah.
The KDE is so much bigger.
But is it, you know, just without thinking about it, I'm a KDE user, but when I on my netbook I've got Cinnamon. Just because it just worked better.
I did actually like Plasma on the tablet. I could never get to be stable enough for its main thing, but just the look and feel of it, it felt good.
Yeah, and the way that the KDE team has been able to integrate that into, well, whatever it calls activities, and actually build the capabilities into the desktop to make it that flexible, and then it's up to the user. But it's got all of those, that's a very KDE thing to do, and I think that's really good. Well, I do think we've reached the end of this podcast, haven't we?
I think so. Yeah.
It's been a quiet podcast. We're all really busy, so this is kind of the middle of the storm.
I think our extra discovery of little Ben Bracken whiskey has made me a bit more subdued.
Yeah.
And Ben's cat.
Yeah.
So we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Ben, for the cookies.
Thank my girlfriend.
Thank you, Ben's girlfriend.
Thanks, Ben's girlfriend. They were nice.
I'll see you tomorrow, Mike.
Yes, see you tomorrow, Graham, for our mystery trip.
Cool. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.